Because one of the things I do try and do, Sergey, is wherever I'm going, this is like pre-COVID, obviously, but I always make it a point to go to a local hairdresser, even if I don't understand the language of the place. Because I want to see how they cut their hair. Like, is there like a universal style or something, or do they have a certain way of doing it, or, you know, how are they going to interpret this head? Because I can tell you, this totally needs a professional job now. And yeah, it was a fascinating way to interact with the local environment if you get a haircut there, you know.
And Hong Kong has a variety of experiences like that, so you can choose.
Yeah, definitely. As you, up and down the socioeconomic scale, but also ethnically as well, and, you know, different cultural influences and all kinds of wonderful things like that. So, yeah, fascinating. Anyway, listen, we're live, everyone. So welcome to Brain Food Live on Air, episode 86. I am delighted to bring it to you as we do every Friday. And it is a special Brain Food Live on Air because it's like super early in the morning in the UK. It's like 7 o'clock. I'm barely like rubbing the sleep out of my eyes, but I wanted to do this show because I had this feeling for such a long time that Asia Pacific, the place where my ancestors are from, is just so underrepresented in the mind share of recruiting and HR. I actually spoke with Nina DeVu, who's coming on a bit later, earlier today, talking about this point. It's like the entire world is obviously massive, but all of the thought leadership, the research, the content, the blogosphere, etc., they all come from like one place. It's all happening from the US, maybe UK, and then maybe a few places in Europe or whatever, Australia, maybe one or two people. And then suddenly you think, you know what, we're probably not speaking to like at least 60 to 70% of the world here. And how do those topics that seem to be important, how do they translate into these other industries, other sectors, other regions, which in fact make up the majority of the world? So this is why we're doing this show, Brain Food Live on Air, Asia Pack special. I might keep doing this as a bit of a regular, actually, because I do think it's super interesting as well as important. But anyway, before we kick off properly, a quick sound check. If everyone can hear me on Crowdcast, please say hello. Say hello on the chat stream, please. If you can hear me on there, that would be great to see. This is just to make sure audio is okay. We are, I think, live streaming across two different channels, three channels, actually. So LinkedIn Live, if you can hear me on there and you can see me there, and you can hear me okay, just give me a quick engagement. Like, dislike, doesn't matter. Just put it on there. Just let me know I can see so you can hear this sound is okay. Facebook Live, anybody awake there? If you can hear me on the Facebook group, just comment on there and make sure you can hear me there also. And we're also live on Periscope. But no one watches there, Sergey. So there's no point asking for anybody to do anything there. Anyway, that's cool. Right. It seems that we can get some people hearing us, which is great stuff. Quick word to our sponsors today, because our sponsors are, in fact, Daxtra. They are. There we go. And not only is Daxtra sponsoring us, but I've also roped in their APAC MD to come in and support the show as a co-host. So Sergey, great to have you on the show. Quick word about Daxtra, actually. It gives a one line on what you guys do.
Thanks for having me on the show. Daxtra is a software company, software services company. We deliver intelligent automation workflows to streamline and make recruitment processes a little bit more efficient, a little bit more automated. We achieve that through using our proprietary machine learning and AI technology.
Can I say something to you, Sergey? I actually came across your brand really early on in my agency days. I would say even guessing you're at least two decades old, because I'm sure I came across Daxtra 2005, 6, 7, something like that. Because we were going to implement something like just a basic parsing solution for our agency at the time. And a guy called Stephen Blackmore, I think. I remember him. I don't know whether he's still in the business, but he was like one of the best salesmen I ever saw. So, Stephen, if you're watching this, I just got to say, you made an impact, bro. I saw the pitch. It was amazing. He's like, oh, my goodness, this guy, I'm paying money. I want to buy this thing. So I remember him. Great to see Daxtra still in the game and doing great stuff. Obviously, these days, we've got some even more data to play with. So I think this market that you guys kind of pioneered is going to be even more healthier, even more exciting for you going forward. So great to have you on the show, Sergey. Yeah, absolutely. Listen, before we bring our guests on the show, I always ask you a question. You're going to disappoint me, man. I know this, but I always ask the question to our co-host, whose only job is to read the newsletter from last week. Did you read it, Sergey? And if you did, what was interesting? And if you didn't, what's your excuse?
Right. Well, I have to admit, I haven't read. I did start reading it because I got your email asking me to read the articles just about an hour and a half ago. But I did find it quite fascinating by just the title. So I started reading the article about the kind of workforce reskilling, moving more into human capital management and investing in learning and experience. So that's very close to us. It rings familiar bells because in Daxtra, we do invest a lot into learning and training our employees. We tend to hire for certain roles, we tend to hire more at the junior level so we can mold and shape them up and train them in our technology. So like bypassing the baggage of old experience that sometimes stands on the way. So that works perfectly for us for certain roles.
You know, idea. On that point, actually, your technology might actually be critically, or your category of technology might be critically important at some point for this kind of remodeling of a business. Because one thing we've discovered over this year is that actually we don't know that much about the people who work in our companies. We hire them, and then suddenly everyone starts and sort of they're working as employees, but they actually sort of produce data in different systems. So suddenly it's payroll and comp data and whatever. That's totally separate from the skills data and the assessment data we collected when we hired them. And those two systems don't talk to each other. They're operated by two different departments. And one of the crises I thought was happening this year, when suddenly we had to redeploy staff because we didn't want to let them go, or because we had a temporary shutdown of the business, we wanted to keep them as employees. Like we didn't know what they could do, didn't know what they wanted to do, or whether they could potentially, you know, be redeployed in this way. So I think unlocking that, connecting that data, those data sources together, I think is a hugely important sort of future path for all companies. Yeah. So hopefully there's a play there for you guys as well. Okay, well, let's get on to the topic at large, Sergey. We're going to be talking about, okay, how do some of these big ideas that seem to be dominating HR recruiting thought leadership, how do they apply sort of regionally and across the spaces? Before I bring sort of our guests on board, I just thought maybe a good idea to get your view, because you're obviously in Hong Kong, and that's where you live, and that's where you've worked for a long time. But you've also got experience in London and different places in different parts of Europe. Also, I think you're French, aren't you, or something like this? I don't know. You're one of these like every person, like you know.
It's confusing when I'm asked where you're from, because that I start jogging my memory and things like that. It's even more confusing for my son because he was born in Hong Kong, so that adds another layer of complexity.
But you've got this really interesting international exposure. So I just wondered, firstly, on the premise that I raised, which is, look, maybe a lot of these big ideas that seem to be super important and, you know, seem to be universal, perhaps they don't translate in the same way in every location. I mean, what is it, for instance, you're looking at things like remote working, for instance. How does that work in a place like Hong Kong? You know, is it like you have to come into the office, or is it actually no, you can work from anywhere? I mean,
well, look, I mean, people who are joining us from other Asian countries and places will probably relate to this better. But Hong Kong never went into a lockdown as such. There were two or three spikes. We had like one in May, one in July. Then the other one was just recently, small one. We're still talking about very, very small numbers of new infections per like 100,000, for example, of population. So the lockdown measures were very, very soft. It was a recommendation from the government. But what is unique about not just Hong Kong and but Asia in general is that the social awareness of every single individual out there, whether it's expats or locals, you see, like it's hardly... It would be shocking to see someone walking without a mask on the street, for example, in Hong Kong. Although the law does not dictate that you have to, it's just the common courtesy that people don't do that. And, yeah. And hence why I guess we're getting very low numbers, and hence why we can come to the office or go to beaches. And
things. All right. So you've actually made a really important point. So my point there wasn't necessarily COVID related, but there's no doubt COVID has really changed the game in the Western world in terms of perception of remote. Because suddenly, because the truth be told, in the West, there has not been mass discipline of any description. Mm. You can see it, anti-mask protesting and stuff like this going on. It's like this is still like a live debate out there. I went to take a bowl of milk earlier this morning to make my porridge. No one was wearing masks. So, you know, we have this, this is still in dispute. That means that obviously we haven't controlled this infection, and it also means that companies are telling people to go home, because when someone gets infected, it's like, oh, we don't want our entire staff to be going down here. Everyone had to go home, you know, whatever. So it's a very real and live experience here. But I wonder whether in territories that have controlled the virus better, remote is actually more remote in the sense that people aren't thinking about it as a thing, because actually this is an episodic thing. We kind of solved it, and basically people are back in the office. So that's actually a really important point. But an example of kind of the differences that we've got in how things operate. Give me one more thing about Hong Kong. I don't want to position you as a Hong Kong expert
Go on. I guess on this topic, I think that the fact that we can go back to the offices now hasn't actually stopped people thinking that remote working is potentially one of the ways forward, because we did work from home, although it wasn't a strict lockdown. It was the government recommendation. So most of the companies, I mean, it was illegal for businesses to insist for you to come home unless you are super, super, like, it's vital for you to be elsewhere. But yes, so for a couple of months, everyone was pretty much working from home. What this similar to UK, I would imagine, or Europe or US, it's just shown that to many companies, including Daxter, that we can operate as efficiently as before, but working from home. Of course, it requires some agility. It requires some preparations and having certain systems in place. But provided you have that, then and it's not difficult to do that. I guess depends on the organization.
As well as this, I'm going to roll out, like, by the way, because I'm like remote from Asia generally in terms of my physical sort of position and also my time there. So I don't really know. I've also never worked there. So I'm going to just basically roll out some like massive cultural essentialism and roll out some regional stereotyping as well. But I'm going to do it because it might be useful to play around with those ideas. I do know, for instance, that property is super expensive in places like Tokyo, Singapore, all of these big cities, two pack, two density. So I think remote actually produces a different problem there, because you might actually have a real ergonomic problem at home in order to do remote work effectively. Whereas in different countries that ultimately you have more sort of internal domestic space, you might be able to refashion a room set to be your home office, for instance. But if you're in a micro apartment in Hong Kong somewhere, that might not be the optimal scenario.
This is very true. This is very true. And that presented a difficulty for some Hong Kongers to be able to work from home.
I remember, I mean, obviously my parents are in villages in the north where they have space, but anywhere in the Hong Kong Island, anywhere in this, where there's density, the life of Hong Kong is outside of the apartments, right? So you kind of spend a lot of time out there. You go home to go to sleep. You know, you don't really spend time chilling out in your apartment. Therefore, you don't have a lot of this stuff. I remember some of my friends saying, yeah, I just never use the kitchen. And I get it, because why would you, right? Like, you can go onto the street and buy something significantly better than you could construct in your own home. And it will be cheaper and better for you to do that. So I think remote has like all of these different implications as well. So anyway, let's bring on some of our other guests here, because you're going to kind of rep Hong Kong. And by the way, if anybody who is sort of in this crowdcast right here and they want to come on screen, just please make yourself available to do that on the chat stream. Just state where you're from and whether you're happy to come on, because I want to try and bring more people onto this, because it'd be fascinating to hop around these countries and see what's what. But I think Matt is here. Now, he's told me he needs to do a school run. So I want to make sure he's on and off the air as soon as possible. There is a Matt. I've invited him on the show. It could be the right Matt. Maybe he's a different Matt. Who knows? I always say, please use your full name. And I know you didn't, Sergey, but thankfully there's only one Sergey here.
I put the company name. My surname is a bit of a mouthful.
So. Sergey Makhmahadov. Makhmahadov? How did you say it?
Sort of. My first email address was S. Makhmahadov. So
Makhmahadov,
we're calling me Smack My Head Off.
That's hilarious. That's fantastic. Okay, cool. So Matt, I've tried to invite you on. I think it is the right Matt. But if not, that's okay. We've also got Guy Wallacott here, who I believe may have some, I think Guy's got loads of experience in different places as well. Maybe even in places like Thailand, Burma, and even, you know, Southeast Asia type territories. Might be cool to have a chat with him also. One more thing on Hong Kong. Tell me a little bit about where we're at with DE&I. So this is actually one of the things that sparked the idea of bringing in, sort of trying to internationalize this conversation, because diversity, equity, and inclusion is important. However, it's perceived to be the same thing universally from where it's emerged, which is typically in the US. And I noticed this actually, a lot of the things that are important in the US literally don't chime even in the UK. There's even in that sort of closeness of business and cultural proximity, it's like it didn't land. So I was just thinking, the further you go, maybe it means even less or a different thing. So how do companies in Hong Kong think about DE&I?
Difficult for me to say. I'm very new to the term. I learned the term early in the year. I've always thought it was a non-issue in Hong Kong, because people are very straightforward. People hire for skills or for experience to be able to fill the gap in certain processes or certain roles. It might be very relevant in the States or perhaps even Europe. In Asia, it definitely exists. I would say that the bias, perhaps in some cases, some discrimination or subjectivity in making a hiring decision definitely exists. But I guess you can't just extrapolate a certain value or certain message verbatim from Western Europe or Western world in general across the entire world. As you said, 60% of the population live in APAC, but guess what? They all speak, like, there are 2,800 languages spoken. I don't remember how many countries altogether in APAC. So we're talking about very, very diverse cultures. The certain cultural aspects need to be taken in consideration, because if you just come with your D&I message to, let's say, a Hong Kong company or Chinese company here, then I don't think it will register with them.
This is one of the real paradoxes of diversity in general, is that in the US, actually, there's a lot of homogeneity that's kind of that you don't think about. For instance, everyone's speaking English, number one, right? I mean, even in the entire sort of continental United States, the working language is English. You go to Asia as a block of comparison, as you say, it is so diverse.
We obviously deal with tons of resumes. We're processing upwards of 100 million resumes from all over the world every month. Now, as such, we are familiar with different styles, cultural styles of writing resumes. So in places like Indonesia, for example, the candidates often would state their religion. In places like China, candidates would often state their party membership. Indian resumes often would list their children with names and ages and their father's name and ages and things like that. So candidates willingly give this information to recruiters. Now, what's stopping recruiters from using this information to perhaps make some sort of like subjective decisions or be biased? Because the candidate obviously authorizes them to use this information. They're providing this information. It doesn't matter if you, like, your software will stop them from searching that. The candidate explicitly states you can use this information. So I think that it should be regulated. I mean, definitely bias decisions and discrimination is controlled here by law as well. And certain things are illegal to ask during the interview. But again, you know, that there are certain aspects that just do not apply in Asia.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's going to be difference, as you say. One thing I want to avoid is to assume that there is. I mean, is there a sense of progress? I mean, I'm split on this. So half of me thinks, yeah, it's great to see progress in the sense that, you know, what, it's probably a good thing that we don't discriminate against someone who is homosexual, for instance. Whereas, you know, 25 years ago, that would probably be the case. You would actually discriminate in this way. So I think there is, I would say, positive progress in that regard. Yeah. But that term is difficult for me to swallow, because we've seen what colonialism has been, which is essentially this idea that the white man is going to go to other parts of the world and encourage progress, quote unquote. you know what I mean? Usually through genocidal efforts or ethnic cleansing or whatever. But it was ideologically supported by a Christianizing mission and a civilizing mission. So I'm very sensitive of the colonial undertones of a lot of these values sort of that are emerging from certain parts of the world, because it reminds me very much of, oh, this is what the Catholics were doing in Latin America, you know, when they were busily converting the heathens, actually exterminating them. And you think, yeah, are we just replicating a very similar pattern without listening to the voices of the local people here, which is part of the reason why I want to do this show. And just as a general idea to try and pick out some voices from here that are doing the recruitings, how does it actually work with zero judgment? So anyway, I'm struggling to get Matt on. However, Casey is here. Casey's in Tokyo, and I want to grab him now because he's probably going to be on his way home in a couple of hours, I would say. Tokyo's ahead of Hong Kong by how many?
1 hour.
1 hour. Okay, it's not too far away. Okay, so let's see if I can get Casey here. I hope he's... appropriately dressed, I've got to say. Like one of the risks of doing this on call, this is why we stopped doing it. We initially, this is the entire show, randomly pulling people on, but they were not appropriate. Sometimes it was not like they were not ready for it. Yeah. So I hope that Casey's ready for it, quote unquote. Anyway, as Luke, by the way, really great to see you. He's getting up also. Luke runs a really cool DE&I recruiting business in the UK. And like I say, Luke, I share with you, it's a fascinating debate, because how diverse is the conversation on diversity, and does it land in different territories? And there he is, Casey, and he is appropriately dressed, and he actually looks more professional than you and I. So, yeah. Casey, how are you doing?
Hi, Casey. Hey guys, good to meet you. How you been?
Yeah, we're good, man. Casey, for the folks who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself, like who you are, where you're based, what do you do?
Yeah. So I'm obviously named Casey. I'm one of the co-owners of HCCR in Tokyo. So we're a blended kind of human capital solutions company. We do a touch of executive search, project-related recruitment, and we've also got offerings in employer branding and kind of human capital consulting here in Japan. Been in Tokyo for 14 years.
Amazing. So you're actually perfect as an experimental person to talk to about this, because obviously you've got some international experience, but now like deep experience in Japan, which I have to say as a country, I think is like really strange, even in regard to within the Asia-Pac region, right? Island country, isolation for a long time, unique language, unique culture, etc. I'd be fascinated to apply those same sort of a question to you. Let's go with remote working as the first thing. Was that ever a thing? Is it becoming a thing? Has COVID pushed it to being a thing? Where do we stand with remote working in Japan, Casey?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, I think it depends on the sector and what part of Japan you're talking about, because I remember, so we went into, first and foremost, Japan legally cannot impose a lockdown. The constitution doesn't actually allow a legal imposition of a lockdown. But there was a very strong request for a lockdown starting on April 7th with the first ever enactment of the emergency order here by the government since World War II. So we went into this kind of essential quasi lockdown phase from April 7th until early June, where everybody was very strongly encouraged to work from home. And so, you know, different, I think, from some other cultures globally, the Japanese, the societal pressure to kind of fall in line and to kind of chip in, everybody do their part, is very strong. So we did go into a very, very, not a very long, but a very strongly encouraged remote working situation there for about 2 months. But then just as soon as that emergency ban was lifted, depending on the industry, a lot of people flocked straight back into, a lot of people flocked back into the office, especially in banking. And I think that one of the biggest challenges in Japan, I think there's two massive challenges here. One, the average personal dwelling footprint is much smaller than it is in many corners of the world. So the reality, especially if you've got kids running around and if you're living in a 500 or 400 square foot apartment with kids running around, getting work done is tough for a lot of people. So I think like that practical aspect is tough. But the other thing I think that this has exposed is the lack of adoption of digital best practices by Japan Inc. They're very, very, very ill-equipped to suddenly go remote. And so you've seen, just from a practical operational perspective, certain things couldn't happen because they had to use their rubber stamp honko to approve purchases of things and stuff like that. So I think that, you know, here it's a bit of a mixed bag, but I would say we're probably 70% back to work for most people. In Japan, we've got a pretty good grip on COVID, although recently the numbers are up. But, you know, that's kind of the whole remote work experience here. And I think you could pretty much apply that across the board here.
That's really fascinating. So I think there's two things there. Number one, how well you handle the COVID-19 is actually going to minimize the likelihood of like a radical move to remote because you've gone back to normal faster. Like and it makes sense to simply persist with previous business practices that have operated okay. Compare that, for instance, to this oscillating situation we're getting in the UK where, now it's locked down for 3 months, or now you're back to the office, now you're locked down again, and we're having this basically switching our operating modes, which is the biggest disruption, right? We're going to get to a point where you're saying, forget about it, stay home, we're going to move. Banking is even a good example. We've had big banks who are saying, look, we're going to extend work from home remote into 2021, and if you think a company is going to basically develop working practices for 12 to 18 months on a remote-only basis, they ain't going back. They're not going back. So this is fascinating how there's probably going to be regional diversity in terms of how all of this operates. Super interesting.
One thing I will say, though, the big thing that's changed is, you know, especially here in Tokyo, you've got this, the famous rush hour trains in Japan where people that live in the suburbs and they're just like, you know, you're packed like sardines in the trains and you're all sweating together on the way in and you're all sweating together on the way out type of a commute. I think that a lot of people through this experience have realized that they never want to do that again. And right. I think that there is pressure that even if it's not full remote, the shifting of like work schedules or more flexibility to have this blended, like, yes, you need to be in the office, but you can be here 5 hours instead of 10 and yeah. Trying to find ways to kind of like mix it together a bit more is definitely something that I think is very front and center because even just from a mental health perspective, people many people here have been talking about how they actually feel healthier in the middle of this pandemic because of the mental strains of not having to go through that commute every day. So I think that's also something that's very front and center here. That's a big topic that you see in the Japanese press a lot.
Really interesting. And of course, the Japanese Tokyo commute in particular was like world famous, right? Everyone is like probably the final form of the commute would be this, where you've got like 30 million people just getting in at the same time, like incredible scenes. And even with that amazing rail system, it was still like totally overloaded with people, right? People would be shoved in. So no one likes that. I read a study by, was it Buffer or something, where they just studied like remote workers, like the number one reason why people wanted to not go to the office was actually the commute. And just to get that out of their lives because no one enjoys that. You're penalizing yourself for 1-2 hours a day with this traumatic sort of exercise, and you know, there's no need. Cool. Before I let you go, Casey, I need to ask you about DE&I. So I came up with the premise to say, you know what, this is all great, however, DE&I is all emerging from certain places in the world, and does it apply universally? where is DE&I with regards to the conversation in Japan? Is it a thing? Is it perceived to be important? Does it look different? What's your view of that?
This is a tricky one here. I think first and foremost, you know, Japan, obviously, it's a very homogenous ethnic country, right? So, you know, they're all Japanese. The other side of it as well, factually speaking, is Japan is also extremely male dominated in the work culture. Very, very, very male dominated. To kind of be blunt, you know, recently they're talking a lot about women in business, and there's all of these initiatives by like the Abe administration to get to 30% women on their board. And we're still sitting at like 7% in terms of women on boards in Japan. So there's a big, it's almost kind of feels like a buzzword push right now about women. It's not about as much about, you know, ethnic diversity as it is about bringing women into leadership and providing opportunities for women. So one thing that's really interesting for us is we're actually starting to get on certain search mandates, SLAs that require female shortlists, which is fine. But then the other problem then that you run into practically in Japan is because they haven't prioritized this for 70 years, there are no qualified women in certain types of skill sets. If you're looking at like automotive engineering R&D heads, you know, good luck finding a woman that speaks fluent Japanese who's been developing like powertrain components for the last 20 years. Like, they don't really exist generally. I mean, there's a couple. So I think that Japan's a little bit more complicated on that front. But then on the other side of it, Japan also has a very big demographic issue, right? I mean, we've got declining population. And a lot of the Japanese, as you see in other kind of, you know, OECD first world countries, they don't really want to do a lot of the labor. So you've seen a big import of labor, blue collar workers from places like Vietnam and Southeast Asia into Japan. So you've actually seen a massive spike in kind of like blue collar or more labor centered work. Or if you go to like a convenience store in Japan, it's almost, you know, probably 50% foreigners now that you see here. So I think Japan is complicated on this because there's a, on one side, there's a complete necessity where they're going to have, they just don't have the demographics to feed the growth that they want to see. But on the other side, culturally, you don't have, you know, it's very homogenous and it's been very male dominated. So the confluence of kind of these two almost kind of counter issues is something that I think Japan is still trying to wrap its head around bit by bit.
It may be the dominant sort of problem or dominant challenge for the Japanese society going forward, isn't it? Like, how do you deal with a culture that has been in this way for a long time, but then you add in the demographic problem, which I think everyone is conscious of. Again, Japan probably being the poster child for this, low birth rate, aging population that does kind of live for a long time due to lots of great reasons, for health reasons and so on. But it does mean that the country's getting grayer, significantly so, and there'll be a crisis point where actually the tax-paying people, generally speaking, are from 20 to 45. They're the yeah. people that earn the most money and pay the most taxes. And if that demographic shrinks relative to other segments of population which don't pay taxes, then you have a massive problem. It's a simple income yeah. and outcome scenario. So input or output, should I say. So very interesting how Japan deals with it. I have seen pushes to get immigration in, like pro-immigration yeah. policies in. But again, yeah. you have cultural barriers, right? Because language is super important. How many people outside of Japan speak Japanese? I would say very small numbers generally. And probably English is difficult to get away with in Japan. You need to speak Japanese at some point. So,
I agree. I think language is an issue. And I think the other thing, and I feel like I can speak at this relatively well. My wife is Japanese, in full disclosure. And, you know, my wife is definitely on the progressive end of the spectrum here. But I also think that there's still this kind of like insulated fear that if they let too many foreigners in, that it's going to dilute the Japanese culture and like the life here as well. And that's not the politically correct way to put it, but that you hear that dialogue in places here as well. So you got to kind of understand it from different angles. And I think that, someone's talking here about the expectations on work hours and raising kids. I mean, expectations here are just very different. So I think taking Western DE&I expectations and pushing it unilaterally on something like Japan, I just don't think it's like, you know, to Sergey's point earlier, I don't think it's going to resonate, except the point on women. The point on women is starting to slowly resonate, but I think it's going to take time.
You know what? This is hugely important. I would say, particularly for companies that are global or international, I forget who it was that had this conversation with me, actually, who said that, you know, all of the headquarters, DE&I team were in the headquarters in London, and they were sending people out. Maybe it was you, Sergey. They were sending people out to Asia, teaching them how to do DE&I. And I was thinking, how's that going to fly? You know, this person doesn't know the local conditions, doesn't know the laws, right? Doesn't know any of that. So what exactly are you going to be doing by going out there and preaching the gospel? Again, I think very similar to Christian evangelicalism, a Catholic kind of proselytization, should
good,
I say,
good analogy.
Back during the imperial era, this is all about, hey, we need to save the heathens from their uncivilized ways. And I was just thinking, okay, we need to really actually have this emerge from within the Asian context. And even within sort of the regional context, city context, whatever, rather than like parachuting in, as you say, using your terms, Casey, unilateral ideas that, or universal ideas that you've done unilaterally. Cool. Listen, Casey, I'm going to let you go because you're a busy man. You got stuff to do. We might bring you back in. Please do watch the rest of the show. But I want to drop in and bring in a couple of our friends from Sing and other places. And we'll keep rotating this around and keep this conversation going. Great to see you, Casey.
All right, guys. Bye.
How fascinating was that? Like very super interesting, totally fascinating.
Especially hearing this from someone who spent 15 years in Japan. I regularly visit Japan when planes are flying, but and we did go through a very, very painful exercise of hiring a senior person in Japan. And you see all that, and then there are different, but what I think is also interesting, I wanted to ask Casey, but I think Japan in general, and it would be interesting to hear the opinion of someone from Japan on this one, but I think we're witnessing a paradigm shift in the whole of the mental approach to employment in Japan, in that traditionally in Japan, your job is your job for life. And I think that is breaking now, starting to break slowly. We're seeing like more agility on the market in terms of workforce movements.
I would be very interested.
That would be interesting to follow up and see how it progresses.
I need to say as well, folks, this is one of these, I'm now tempted to do like a country specific show about this because, you know, we can't do it in like 10, 15 minutes. But it is so fascinating. And we have to put everything into cultural context. We have to put everything in historical context. And Japan, obviously, over the last 150 some years, have gone through tremendous period of change after a long period of isolation. So you imagine like when the Meiji Restoration occurred up until now is only really, what, 200 years or so. And then in that time, you had all kinds. You had Japanese imperialism. You had overthrowing the samurai class. You had World War II. And before then, you know, a conquest all over sort of Asia. And then you had the American domination, you had impoverishment, you had the craziness. So very, very interesting. But let's move on because we've got other people to talk to that we can contribute in different ways. So let's drop into Singapore. Because we all love Singapore. Also, one of those cities, I think similar to Hong Kong in some respects, in the sense that, oh, kind of a Western-friendly place. But let's see exactly what we have to offer here. I want to see if Nina's here.
The two places in Asia where you don't actually, you are not forced to learn the local language to be.
Well, yeah, I mean, these are both British colonies at some point, very recently. And so the British English language was the dominant way of having conversations, certainly in business and probably still is. So really interested to see what these guys have got to say. There's Martin. Martin, good to see you, sir.
Hi, Hung. How are you going? Good to see you.
I like the beard, by the way. It suits you.
Yeah, so this I started growing this on the day that we started working from home in Singapore. So my theory is I'll shave it off the day we go back.
Right, don't. I think it makes. I think it adds power, man. It makes.
Does it?
Yeah, additional gravitas. I wonder has your management improved as a result of your having a beard?
I'm not sure my management has improved, but I can tell you a funny story. I was on a team management team the other day, and one of the guys on the call, their kid was in the background, and they said afterwards, "Is Santa Claus work for you?" They thought I was Santa Claus, so I'm not sure if that's a compliment or not.
And the right answer should have been yes. Yes, Santa Claus is employed as our head recruiter. Yeah, what right. he does. Okay, cool. We have Martin here, and we have also Nina. Nina Davouche, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Very excited to be here.
Great to see you, Nina. Okay, so let's do some quick introductions. Martin, for the people who don't know you, who are you and what do you do?
So, Martin Warren. So, originally from Australia, so moved up to Singapore about 5 years ago. So, my role at the moment is I work for Grab. For those of you who've been to Southeast Asia, you probably know Grab. So, I head the talent sourcing function here at Grab.
Fantastic. And Nina, quickly introduce yourself, who you are, what do you do?
So I'm Nina. I lead the talent acquisition team for APAC for the Trade Desk. If you don't know about the Trade Desk, we are a demand supply side platform, for the media industry. What else do I do? Oh yeah, so I'm Singaporean. I have a French name because I'm married to a French.
Cool, fantastic stuff. And I've just shared the links to these two folks into the chat there. So if you need to follow either Nina or Martin, please do so there. Okay, cool. We're going to be talking about, and I don't know whether you're paying attention to some of the chat we had before. We had Casey on, we had Sergey talking as well a little bit. Let's talk about remote working as the first thing. In the Western world, this is like the biggest deal ever, right? Because suddenly with COVID-19, I would say Europe and US clearly have failed to handle this in any sort of positive regard. We've had to just lock down repeatedly. And it's really kind of educated people to think, okay, we have to have and develop a remote working, remote first way of organizing our business. But Sergey introduced to me the idea, actually, if you've controlled the virus early, people have gone back to the office early. So there hasn't been this like traumatic shift. Has that been the situation in your experience, Nina?
In Singapore, I would say the government's really careful, right? I think we like to play on the safe side a lot. So I remember, you know, like in Hong Kong, you guys didn't go to lockdown. We went into lockdown here. I know the kids were taken out from school for a while. That drove me absolutely nuts because we all were at home all of a sudden. You know, I think even for myself, I actually quit my job because I couldn't take the stress anymore. So mentally, I was like, oh my God. And then as soon as, and at the same time, I had the opportunity to interview with the Trade Desk. And I remember coming in throughout the whole interviews, having only video calls as interviews, coming in and being onboarded remotely, not even meeting a single person on my team. Maybe some of my team members are here now. But, you know, I couldn't even meet anybody. I couldn't even come into the office. I remember it was one of the weirdest moments, but it completely redefined what remote working was for me and a lot of the people out here. I went to the office for the first time last week. There were only a handful of people there, but it was a great opportunity for me to like get a sense of feel of the culture. And as you know, for a recruiter, it's very important to be the guardian of the culture, right? For anyone who's coming into the team. So even so, I know in Hong Kong, for instance, you can still take off your mask while in the office, right? In Singapore, you can't.
Yes, I'm in the office now. We don't wear masks in the office.
Correct. In Singapore, you can't. You can't. Ooh. You have to keep your mask on at all times, even if you're in a meeting room by yourself, because there are what we call safe distancing ambassadors who will come in and check and make sure that we're all following the rules. So then, you know, there's this part of me that goes like, as a recruiter as well, like, how will I really be able to read someone's face if I'm constantly being put, vice versa, right? If we both have masks on. And that's why, you know, at the end of the day, I think for our jobs, it's actually much easier to stay remote so that we can actually have conversations like this and to be able to read facial expressions and really drill down to the nuances of it.
I was waiting for my mind to be blown, and I knew Nina was going to do that. Seriously, I had it predicted. Like the idea, like all these local things, we don't know. Like we don't know that in Singapore, you have to wear your mask indoors in the office. And it does make sense, by the way, from what we know about aerosol transmission and it moving through the ventilation systems of all of these types of places. We get it. This is important. But of course, from recruiting, I need to see the face. Of course you do, right? Especially video call. Like I've never done a video call where people are wearing masks, but presumably if you're in the office, that's what you've got to do.
Yeah, exactly.
That's crazy. That's totally crazy.
But then Singapore has done spectacularly well with the numbers. I mean, there were like a few scary clusters there, but if you look at the mortality rate, it's just exemplary.
Yeah, well, this is it.
I mean, I would say most of Asia can report this type of response, which, you know, and what is interesting is that it's coming from different sort of political systems. It's coming from different laws at that level. I mean, I didn't know Japan actually didn't do a lockdown. They just strongly encouraged. But it turned out strong encouragement coming from Japan is a different thing in the UK or in Australia even, where, you know, I think they did a strong encouragement, but everyone's just having beach parties
people. Victorians on here to talk about this.
Well, I mean, if this show continues, my thought was to actually do a two-hour one and maybe bring some Aussies and Kiwis in later on. So if people are interested, I can continue rolling this through. And it might be interesting to try and do that, because we have seen evidence of success in Australia also, but only when they were really hard and saying, look, there's a $500 fine if you're walking around on the beach without a mask. It doesn't matter whether you're by yourself, you are getting fined. But then Victoria managed to lock it down as a result of this, and then people can come back to the office. So it just needs to be done. And it's an implementation challenge, and it's a compliance challenge. And this is where we're seeing the failure of this. I would say most places in Europe, certainly in the US as well. And I think it has a huge impact on remote, simply because if you fail to handle it, you're going to develop systems to work remote. You're going to insist on it. I guarantee you, the dude that's went and bought a $500 chair, you know, a gaming chair to work from home and all this kind of stuff, he is not going to be that motivated to go back to the commute. He's going to sit in his chair and think, I've set my reconfigured my home to do this. I'm doing it from here now. So whereas countries that have had a much shorter experience in and out, maybe it's like, okay, we go back. But again, we can see differences maybe between Hong Kong and Sing as well. Okay, cool. Tell us a little bit about other things in before we hit sort of these other topics, Nina. I'm interested to know about recruiting in general from Asia Pac as a sweep, because I know that you have like an APAC kind of responsibility. So it's not just Sing. Where else do you have responsibility to hire, Nina?
So at TTD, we have an office in Japan, in Korea, we have an office in Australia, soon to be two, an office in Singapore, where we actually manage a lot of our Southeast Asia hiring out of Singapore, Hong Kong, and Shanghai. This year for us was actually a year, obviously, with a lot of a lot of companies as well, where we had all these growth expansion plans that we actually had to really scale back on. But next year, we're going to be growing a bit more aggressively, and we'll be opening some of the new markets out of the hubs that we already have. So I give an example: we're going to be entering some of the other small Southeast Asian markets, but we're not going to actually have an office there until COVID's able to stabilize. We'll be doing a fly-in, fly-out model whenever possible. But you know, that is just to say, like, you know, essentially, we can't allow the pandemic to completely slow us down in terms of our expansion plans, right? Because, as you know, so I just wanted to share that with you. So, in terms of recruiting in general across APAC, where do I start? Like, what exactly do you want to know? I mean, it's like such a huge topic. I don't know.
Too big. It was too big. I get it. So I was. Let's roll this one out. So, are there like clear like cultural differences between these Asian countries? And what struck out to you? I mean, there's going to be. But what struck out to you is like surprised you? You know, when you're recruiting in Korea or something that even you didn't know. You know.
Well, I would say I think the most complicated market in my mind would be Japan. Who was it just now who came up?
Casey.
Yes. Sorry, Casey. And Casey was only scratching like the tip of the iceberg, right? He was barely on the surface when he talked about, some of the cultural nuances and especially like women in leadership positions. But I think like for me, Korea and Japan were like the two really, really like until today, I don't think I understand it. Right, I cannot safely say I've understood it because I've never worked in Japan. I've been to Japan and Korea, but I've never worked in there the way that someone like Casey would be. And it's very, and I don't necessarily think I would have even scratched the surface. Mm. But for me, I think, you know, it's very hard to, you know, when people compare us, they're like, yeah, in Asia, in America, you know, we do this, and sometimes people compare us like, oh, East Coast, West Coast versus, and you're like, it's a little, I get that every country has their nuances. I get that every region has its challenges, but I personally find the APAC region really fascinating because of all the languages, right? All the cultural differences, you know, like even in, if you look at markets, right? How some countries are still very far behind and how some countries are further ahead, right? Depending on which industry you're in. And then obviously that will also, and what the government policies are and how the government's actually also helped support the education program. So like in Singapore, it's a lot to do with STEM. For instance, the government's really pushing for STEM. The government's really pushing for tech hubs to be built out here in Singapore as well. So what are the government's priorities, and how do they continue to incentivize local companies to do that? So there's a lot, right, that you know you can cover, right? But I think it's really how the what really is, I would say, very fascinating is how multifaceted it is, how multidimensional it is, not just culturally. It's also tied to policies. It's also tied to a lot of these global mobility, right? A lot of Western influence coming into, like a lot, you know, I give an example in China, in countries like India, you have like tier one, tier two, tier three cities. It's so like, so complex that, I mean,
different between the tiers.
Oh, very different. Like, yeah, very, very different. And it's about like right timing, right place, right time. And yeah, just all of that.
On this note, just very jumping real quick. For the folks who are listening from South Asia, from India and Bangladesh, places like that, I deliberately didn't sort of invite any guests from those regions because I want to do a separate show there. Because obviously it is like just, this is so big a pie already. That there's, you know, we can't do a rest of the world type of deal on this. But again, a huge and very interesting. All of this is, by the way, super fascinating, I think, for everybody, because one of the conversations that's occurring, at least in the Western world where I'm kind of interacting with people, is this idea that the world of remote basically returns the global war for talent. Because suddenly companies are starting to ask the question, oh, this person is now looking to work from remote where previously they needed to be in the office in London. What does that mean? Oh, why does it need to be even in London? Why does it need to be in the UK? Can we push this job to wherever the person is around? And then suddenly they're going to have to interact with people that perhaps they'd never thought about interacting with all of those cultural differences, legal problems, fiscal challenges, all of those types of things. So I think this conversation is super interesting. Casey mentioned something about DE&I. I thought it was really interesting, Nina. I wonder whether you could give us a kind of an overview of this. He was saying, look, in Japan, generally speaking, the focus is on gender. It's too homogenous to think about ethnic diversity, right? So he says, like, everyone in Japan more or less is Japanese. You have to speak Japanese even if you're not Japanese. So, you know, these are requirements of the job. So straight away, you don't necessarily have an ethnic diversity problem, or you don't think of it as a problem simply because there is no talent pool. Whereas gender is a different story. Everyone is basically 50-50 in their societies. So how does that sort of characterization meet with your view of, as you say, different territories in Asia, Nina?
So my general view, and this is purely my personal view on it, is it is right now that the diversity problem, I really feel it's really trying to solve for women in leadership. And it's very similar to what Casey had said. This is across all the countries that we're seeing. I give you an example, you know, whether let alone tech, right? Like, I know I work in the tech industry, but I've one of the things that we like Visa, MasterCard, Accenture, these are all like much bigger, much more developed, much more mature organizations, and they're still trying to solve for diversity, like gender diversity. I think Accenture had a a plan to have like 50-50, you know, women and men in terms of the organization. But I think also that I can't remember what the KPIs were that they were trying to reach, but definitely, you know, having more women in leadership roles. And that's something that we're seeing throughout. But that's also, again, historically, back to what Casey had said, you know, in Japan, we just haven't really built that infrastructure up for women to take, you know, to really push women into these roles, you know, and that's really par for the course every single, like in every single country, right? Whether you're in Thailand, whether you're in Vietnam, like women were historically meant to stay at home and take care of the kids, right? It was only in the last probably like 15 years, even in Singapore, where, you know, we actually had a domestic, like more and more domestic helpers coming in. We actually had to, you know, having more domestic helpers, workers coming in to help us take care of our children. Then, you know, that was another problem in itself, because then that over dependency. And then now, but at the same time, that brought up, you know, more of a push for childcare centers. And so then that further really like made the system of you know child rearing, I do it this way, you know, more robust, which then allowed women to feel comfortable and confident to have kids, to want to be able to take, you know, to want to be able to push themselves at work, right? And not just lead a comfortable life, but actually be able to say, okay, right, I can have as many kids as I want, but I can also have a career. And again, this is also the same in some of the other smaller markets, right? Like in Thailand, the infrastructure is not as robust, right? It's not as formalized, right? Same in Vietnam, it's not as formal. And also that's also the thing, right? You know, the mom guilt, which I hashtag have, hashtag mom guilt, which I'm guilty of as well. You know, And that's also why I quit my job in the midst of COVID, right? Because I felt I can't do this. I don't want to be in the midst of pandemic and being stressed about having to take care of the household, having to make sure everybody's healthy, having to homeschool my kid all at once, right? So, yeah, I think at the end of the day, long story short, I think we're actually, thanks, Joel. You know, I actually feel like the problem we're really trying to solve is not just having more women in the workforce, but really women in leadership positions.
You know what, Nina, thank you so much for that. Again, mind is blown a little bit here. And the main thing for me is like childcare is different in different countries. And it is emerged, I'm just using UK as a template, but this really emerged as a result of World War One. Like the childcare in the UK, the foundation of it emerged as a result of a massive global conflict where all of men were more or less conscripted enough to go to war, and women had to step in to take on the roles of keeping society moving whilst the men were in the trenches. And that really had a sea change in terms of how, you know, schooling started to be formalized at that point, because as I think we're now starting to work out with COVID-19, a big part of schooling is actually to release the workforce from domestic labor. It's not necessarily about teaching the kids how to be smarter, because you know what? I don't think schooling necessarily does that. It's about optimizing for the labor distribution. So you get more or less, it's, you know, one person, one parent effectively takes care of 30 kids, and that releases 29 parents to go and do some work. Or do some paid work, should I say, for the economy. So it's an optimization strategy, but it emerged from a very specific context, meaning World War One, and of course then World War Two. So you had these two rapid, big changes, similar to COVID, huge changes that forced societies to shift, and then all of it kind of emerged as a result of this. But different countries didn't have that experience. And whilst there was war and trauma in different parts of Asia, there wasn't a huge shift of labor in the same way, where all the men went off to war and all the women had to step into different roles. So perhaps the way of child rearing was more persistent in the same way. Women looked after the men. It looked after the kids, looked after the men as well, but looked after the kids. And that never moved away, right? So that conflict that tension is still going on. Super fascinating. And again, something we want to dive into in more depth probably with a smarter host than me. But anyway, Nina, listen, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to let you go because there's a couple more people I want to bring on, but wonderful to have you on the show. Sorry we lost Martin, by the way. I think he's still trying to get back on, God bless him, but he's gone. Great to have you, Nina. Good luck with what you're doing. And yeah, hopefully we'll catch up soon, okay?
No, thank you very much for having me. It's been, I'm really, really very happy with this initiative coming up towards APAC. And so, yeah, looking forward to learning from everyone else.
We'll do more of it.
Thank you.
Take care, Nina. How fascinating was that?
Incredibly.
Super, super interesting. Like, again, yeah. We just don't know the historical context. And I'm just rewinding back. Of course, you know, so I'm from the villages. My family are basically paddy farmers, you know, two generations back. And essentially, women had kids. Obviously, they did. But they did work in the field, you know. Yeah. They were working. There was no such thing as a stay-at-home mom. You were stay in the farm, ma, you know, kid on the back whilst you're in the field. So it's like super hard work. But the guy was the guy earning the money. So in other words, women persisted more in the subsistence economy, literally farming from the land and doing that. Whereas, you know, when the market economy started to arrive, that's when my grandpa started becoming like a truck driver. My other grandpa started to just do some, you know, laboring and stuff like this, which women didn't do at that time. They were still at home because bigger families, three, not one kid, right? Hard enough to handle, but you're talking about three, four kids, etc. Yeah. Different ages. There's no way you're going anywhere. You know, you have to be that. That's a full-time job in itself, but you're still doing the work in the farm. So, super interesting. Oh my goodness. Okay, let's see if we bring one more person on. We've lost a few. The lineup has shifted on us, folks, and this is purely because of internet problems. But internet solutions, which ultimately means we can just randomly bring someone on, which is what I'm going to try and do. So I can see Gary Woolacott here, and Gary, if you're still here and you're ready to come on, I'm going to invite you on because I'd love to hear from you, particularly about Southeast Asia. So we talked about Hong Kong, Japan, Singapore, big countries like this, as we talked about, as Nina touched on, smaller markets, which in themselves are not small, Vietnam, Thailand, you know, those types of places, what is happening there, super exciting. So see whether we can bring Gary on and he can help us with some of that. This is fascinating. Sergey, was this my idea or was it yours to do an Asia Pac?
It was my idea, of course.
I'm
joking. I think we were just chatting, Hong, and then you just said that, oh, I just have a brilliant idea. Now let's go APAC. So yeah, that's how these ideas are usually conceived, from chats and conversations.
Which is proving maybe we can still do it in a remote setting. Like one of the concerns that people have with the push to remote is, are we going to recover the creativity that comes from the across the desk type of dialogue? And I think we probably will have a trade-off there because you're going to lose a little bit of creativity, but we managed to innovate a little bit here, which is good. Yeah. So
I think given the right collaboration tools available to employees, then creativity does not need necessarily to suffer. I think you are referring to working as a team and perhaps bouncing ideas of each other, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like the idea of, you know, when you're having dialogue and so, oh, there's Gary. Hey, Gary, how are you doing?
Hi, Gary.
I think you're mute, my friend. Gary, we've got a sound problem, I think. It might be good for you to maybe refresh the browser and then come back. I'm not even sure you can hear us. Tell you what, Gary, I'm gonna kick you off. And I'll invite you back on. Boom. All right. This might or might not work. Folks, this is a live show. This is what happens. It's all exciting. boom. Let's invite Gary back on. I'd love to revisit Southeast Asia a little bit. I was in Bangkok maybe 2 years ago. Amazing city, obviously. Craziness, actually. Craziness I hadn't seen for a long time for multiple reasons, right? Like multiple layers of crazy. And I think it gets
That's very accurate, actually.
Do you know what I mean? It's like different forms of crazy.
It's a multi-layered city on so many levels.
Right, exactly. And I only had 3 days there, and I'd love to spend more. But there's so much part of Southeast Asia I haven't been to, and that is like 500 million people, isn't it? I mean, it's like huge amounts of people living there. Burma I've never been to, Cambodia never been to, Laos I've never been to, Vietnam even I've not been to. You know, I should go and check those places out, because guess what? They have young populations. They're growing economically. They start to take manufacturing away from places like China, for instance. So if you witness the economic growth of places like China over the past two, three decades or more, you can potentially anticipate a similar trajectory for these territories.
These territories are growing faster than China.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And it's exciting to get into. And what does that mean from a recruiting point of view, right? You know, what is the challenges of this type? I can hear Gary, but not see him. I think.
Yeah, I'm trying to get in.
Gary, we can hear you fine.
We can hear you.
I don't know why you can't see me, fellas.
Don't worry. I mean, we can do it by voice. You can be disembodied Gary for the time being. Gary, thanks for coming on like on spec. I appreciate we didn't arrange for this. So I really appreciate you being brave enough to step in. For the people who don't know you, Gary, I wonder whether you could quickly introduce yourself, like who you are, where you're based, and what do you do?
Yeah, I'm Gary Woolacott. I'm managing partner of Horton International here in Thailand and Vietnam. I've been living here for 25 years now.
Amazing. Great stuff, Gary. I think you've been watching the show so far. I've just shared Gary's link, LinkedIn, but on chat stream, by the way. Please feel free to connect with Gary. And we were just talking about, okay, how do these global ideas, how universal really are they? How do they apply? Tell us about remote working in the territories that you're working in, Gary. Has that been a thing? I mean, in the Western world, it's been like, oh my goodness, we're now remote first. The scales have dropped from our eyes. We're never going back to the office. How does this feel in the places where you deliver your services?
Well, let's start with Thailand. I know a little bit more about Thailand than Vietnam. Government locked down quick and early, and that was very effective in controlling the virus. So we've only had 60 people die since the beginning of it. But that's come amazing. At a terrible economic cost. That 12% of our economy has disappeared, international tourism, and it doesn't look like people are coming back anytime soon. One hesitates, critical, but the workforce is quite unprepared for this kind of adjustment. So the lockdown was interesting. I think Western companies broadly coped better than local companies, probably because they were a little more technologically advanced, but everybody was faced with the same thing. One plus benefit that a lot of people enjoy, just as in Tokyo, the commute. Those of you who've been to Bangkok, you'll be familiar with how well our traffic flows here. And avoiding a 2 or 3 hour commute both ways for some people was a really good thing. Against that, the office is quite a simple place and people are happy to be together. It's a very collegiate working environment in Thailand, culturally collegiate. And so a lot of people miss that. Even a few years ago, when we talked about moving to a 4 day week, we took a vote and we were outvoted. The Thais wanted to come to work every day. Part of that might be just as in other countries, the living accommodation isn't such that they want to be at home all the time, but they do very much enjoy coming to work generally. So that would be a snapshot for you.
That's really interesting, Gary. Thank you for that. It sounds to me then that a combination of effective lockdown plus this idea of, you know, limited space at home means that remote working is not necessarily perceived as a long-term future for a lot of companies in Thailand, and there will be some sort of return to the office at some stage.
Yeah, we were out of the office for much of April and May, We've been free to go back since then. There's no mandated lockdown. But here, just as in other parts of Asia, we're very good about wearing our masks. There's no legal requirement to wear it, but the social pressure is that people do when we're out and about in public, traveling on the street and that type. Not in private, a different matter. Large gatherings are discouraged, and but as far as I'm aware, not banned socially, but people are pretty good. And of course, we have another big advantage here in Thailand, which is when we wipe them, we don't shake hands. And so that has undoubtedly helped a lot over the years.
Absolutely. I mean, the greeting, it was, wasn't there like everyone's doing the Indian namaste greeting now, because you don't need to physically touch people. And you do wonder whether the handshake may disappear in many respects. You have to think twice at least. I can't remember the last time I shook anybody's hand, I have to say. Definitely months. It's probably going to get to years actually now before I've done that, because it's like you think twice. And there's an awkwardness. When there's an awkward pause, it doesn't happen. It has to be like straight away. So I think, big cultural shift. Maybe some of the older stuff there would be a real big determinant. But super interesting to hear your thoughts on that, Gary. Quick one before we let you go. Talk to us about DE&I. Again, we've learned that it means different things in different places. How does that sit in the Thai business culture there so far, Gary? I think we've lost them.
Just on the line dropped out. Just go back to that last question, please.
Yeah, it was a DE&I. How does that actually apply in the Thai business context?
Okay, much like Japan, the people of Thailand are quite homogeneously Thai. And there are plenty of foreign workers here, but not largely integrated into the force in any significance. So it really comes back to male female and trying to encourage women into position here. And I would go out on a limb and say Vietnam is the same. The women are the ones who work this. But here in particular, it's a patriarchal society, so there tend to be more men at the top of the pile. It's a struggle to get women to step up. And just like in other
Gary,
countries,
I think we're struggling to get
so
you, man.
Years, now it's very difficult to try to fix it quickly.
Yeah. Gary, I think I got what you mentioned there. It is all about
all right.
Sort of...
Okay, I'll go. Thank
you. No.
Thank you.
I appreciate you, Gary. Thanks for stepping in. But very interesting. I think there's a couple of themes there. The homogeneity of the society itself actually makes a big impact as to how important diversity and inclusion is as a topic. And again, this is something in the Western world, perhaps, that we forget, because we've kind of accreted a culturally diverse society, ethnically diverse society, through lots of different reasons. US in particular, obviously based on immigration. You have UK, big colonial empire, lots of people coming into the country. Therefore, they look different, sound different, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, diversity becomes like a bigger thing. Ethnic diversity becomes a bigger thing. But if you're going to a country that didn't have that experience, never had big immigration flow, for instance, you've got a culturally homogenous place, Korea, Japan, classic examples, the conversation doesn't emerge simply because there was never friction in that same regard. So that was a revelation for me right away, which I didn't know. Okay, folks, I think that's about it. I'm going to close it off here because Sergey needs to go to take a toilet break, it looks like. I don't need to stop him from doing that. I hope you enjoyed the show. I was absolutely fascinated by this, and I want to continue talking about it, actually. So I'm going to find some other excuse to do it. Definitely, we're going to examine India and South Asia, if we can do that at some other point. ANZ also, we're going to revisit this at some other stage because we've got other sort of challenges on that side also. I just want to thank everyone for paying attention. For the folks who are in Asia Pac right now, really great to connect with you. If you enjoy this type of show, by the way, feel free to follow the channel. This is going to be on replay for everyone, so you can watch it afterward. And there's going to be additional content of this type in different territories as well. Big thanks to our sponsors, Daxtra, of which Sergey is our representative today. Not only have they supported the show, but I've got this guy to sit there for an hour and a half to join it. And actually, Sergey, we've lost you on mute, which is probably just as well.
Sorry. I was just saying that's fine. I really enjoyed today's meeting and conversation. And guys, if you have any questions, if you want to pick my brains on Hong Kong or in general APAC practices, I guess I've been here for quite some time, like many others on here. So feel free to reach out on LinkedIn or via home.
What I'll do is I will send an email to everyone who's registered on the show and give the links to everyone who appeared. So if you want to interact with those folks there, please do so. And we'll pick it up from there. Thank you again for sponsoring. Daxtra are you're basically a data everything business as far as I see it. We're in a data business as recruiters and HR people. We're dealing with ever more data going forward. If you want like a way to basically improve, enrich, and get better value out of your data, you need to figure out where Daxtra is all about. I think I saw Luke there. He agreed with me. We knew about this brand like in 2003. He's still there 20 years down the line. That tells a huge story in of itself. We need to all get better at using our human capital information. So do check out Daxtra. By the way, you've got some new tools, haven't you, Sergey? I wonder whether you can end this by telling us a little bit about the new thing that you rolled out 2 weeks ago, something like this.
We aim to release a new product every couple of years. We aim to have 3 or 4 updates to existing products every year and a major feature once a year. So this particular release is a major iteration, new iteration of our search and matching platform that gets embedded into clients' existing ATS or recruitment platforms. And it enables you to seamlessly match jobs to candidates through text understanding technology. And it does it cross-language as well. So, for example, you can have a job spec in Japanese and the match comes back in English language. So that saves a lot of time. So if you're interested, I would be happy to talk to you about this.
Can you share the link to that in the chat stream? Because we can aggregate those links at some point and get it out to people. But that's super interesting. Sure. Because a lot of businesses have accrued huge amounts of candidate data. And it's just sitting there in a database somewhere, not being accessed because it's not organized. The taxonomy isn't being fixed. The data is not structured in the same way, so it's matchable. So essentially, if you have a tool that can pass all of that into something that is created into a taxonomy, you can activate that information and not just have it take up a space in the memory. Okay, cool.
A quick link, so if anyone wants, there is a video clip.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, that's about it. Thanks, everybody. We're going to leave it there. Enjoy your evening and weekend, everyone in Asia Pac. Anybody who's tuning in different sides of the world, enjoy the rest of your working day. This is Brain Food Live. We'll be with you again next week. We're going to be talking about, what the hell are we talking about next week? I don't even know, Sergey.
Well, we have some time to figure out, I guess.
No, we have the show. It's set up. Oh, I get it. It is going to be about how to create a stronger relationship between HR and TA, because that relationship is critical for how we both do our jobs going forward. How do you actually build a positive relationship with this partner, which sometimes can be friction-based, can be antagonistic? So we've got some amazing guests with us. Lisa Scales from Nestle is coming to join us. We have got, Lisa's enough on her own, but there's going to be plenty of cool people there as well. Make sure you join that show. Okay, that's about it. Enough talking from me. I will see you next week. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, folks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, so that is it. Thank you, everybody. It's been awesome having you.